This recording is brought to you by Whitworth University. To hear additional programs, please visit www.whitworth.edu/podcast.
Good evening. It's great. I just stand up here and you quiet down. I bet there's a lot of teachers in the audience. That's wonderful. Well, my name is Michael Arroy, and I'm the Vice President for Academic Affairs and Dean of the Faculty here at Whitworth University, and it's my pleasure to welcome you here tonight for our Lindemann Lecture. And I've been very pleased to work with a colleague who is highly esteemed in the Whitworth community over the past several years in a lot of capacities, but her most recent role at Whitworth is the Lindemann Chair. And this is a special endowed chair that was endowed in honor of President Lindemann, who was one of Whitworth's presidents in the 1970s. And he was fascinated with the intersection of ethics and social issues. He described himself at that time as a futurist, somebody who was interested in how the social issues would unfold and how the Christian faith and ethics would intersect with that. And we have this endowed chair now supports a faculty member on the Whitworth faculty for 4 years. So it's a competitively awarded chair, and it's awarded to a faculty member who is doing exemplary work in the intersection of ethical thinking and with relevant social issues. And when Betty applied for the chair, it was a kind of different application than we would have received, say, from a social scientist in political science or sociology. But it was so intriguing. The body of work that she was working on seemed so important to the committee. And I'll just speak personally. Several years ago in my own family, I had a nephew who was born and struggled in his early years, and his parents really struggled to understand him and know him and know the challenges that he was encountering. And he early on, at age 5 or 6, he was diagnosed with Asperger and autism. And so this issue for me became a very personal one and a very real one as I saw parents struggle to understand how to be helpful, and also as they struggled with the real lack of information out there to be helpful to both the teachers that they were trying to interact with, as well as, you know, as parents to try and understand how to be supportive. And it has been, actually, if I have heroes in my life, it is my brother and my sister-in-law who are valiantly working with this wonderful boy whom I love to help raise him well and to help him know that he's loved and know what his gifts are. And so I sent an email to my brother tonight right before coming over here just saying how pleased I was and proud I am to work with a colleague, Betty, in this work, to be in the role involved in supporting the excellent work that she has done. And not only has she done this work in her own right, but she has gathered together a group of faculty across campus in fields like computer science to think about new ways that this interdisciplinary focus and work can serve students like my nephew Jacob for the long haul. And so I don't know much at all about this field, but I so appreciate and admire the work that Betty is doing, and I'm very pleased that Whitworth is the place that she chooses to do it. Let me introduce her to you briefly. She received her doctorate from the University of Kansas in developmental child psychology. And that was after teaching as a classroom teacher in special education for many years. She was a faculty member at Gonzaga University for 19 years. Perhaps you've heard of that. I hear they have a good basketball team. And we didn't even have to make a trade, but she came to Whitworth University 12 years ago, and we're really quite happy that she chooses this as her intellectual home. During her time here, she has been an outstanding faculty member, a model to junior faculty and faculty peers alike. She's been elected our faculty president and served very well in that role, and is just a fantastic leader, colleague in the School of Education. And I know the School of Education is quite proud of her in the same way that we are proud of her and appreciate her gifts as well. So it's my privilege and pleasure to introduce her and to celebrate the learning that she brings to us tonight and to commend the legacy that she represents that would make President Lindemann proud. So without further ado, thank you very much, Betty.
Thank you. Thank you so much for coming. As I've always said when I've done this presentation, there's just nothing more heartwarming than looking around this room and seeing so many people I know from so many different facets of my life. It's always great to see you gathered together. I also see a lot of new faces here tonight, and perhaps because the first two presentations were on the more serious end of the autism spectrum, and this time we're going to look at people with more mild disabilities in the autism spectrum. Now, one thing I do have to ask you is if you see people looking around for seats, if you might move a space or two closer to the center and leave some of those at the on the aisles open, because we do find parking is a problem here, so people keep gathering for the next 10 minutes or so as they come into the room. Let me see who I'm talking to here tonight. How many of you are teachers or therapists who work with children with autism or Asperger? Raise it up really high. Okay, thank you. That's a lot of you, a lot of professional connections here. And how many of you are here tonight because you have a family member who has autism or Asperger disorder, and you're here to add to what you already know about it? Wow, it's a little overlap there as well. And are any of you here who are Asperger or high-functioning autism, and you've come to hear what we're talking about? Okay. Thank you very much. We will see that number increase because we're seeing such an increase in people with autism spectrum disorders. Now, one thing I do want to preface before I begin talking to you is that as I talk about this diagnosis, we use the terms disabilities and disorders and dysfunction and deficits and so on throughout the presentation, because that's a little bit of the way our professional language is. But I want you to take this from the perspective that the challenges that are presented by having autism spectrum disorder are hurdles that need to be overcome, but they're not necessarily obstacles that will keep people from success. And what I want to talk to you about tonight are the characteristics of those hurdles and what those implications are then for learning and success in life, and also give you some suggestions for what we can do to help that person be more successful. So I want to start with this quote from Tony Atwood, who is a therapist who has worked with thousands of people with Asperger's syndrome. And I appreciate his perspective on this, because he says, and forgive me for reading slides, but we are audio taping this, and some people will get the tape without the photographs. I usually say to the child, "Congratulations, you have Asperger's syndrome," and explain that this means he or she is not mad, bad, or defective, but has a different way of thinking. And not to make light of this disability, but another of my favorite quotes from Tony Atwood is, "A cat is just a dog with Asperger's syndrome." And I think what you need to think about during this presentation is, this is one of the very few cats who has to live in a world that was totally designed for and by dogs for their pleasure and their convenience. And so a cat comes with a different perspective and has to navigate that same environment. Both high-functioning autism and Asperger disorder are part of autism spectrum disorders, and those fall under a definition from the American Psychiatric Association, which says you will show deficits in three areas. There will be social deficits, there would be evidence of restricted interest, odd or repetitive behaviors, and there will be language and communication difficulties. And I'll elaborate on what those might mean for people with Asperger and high-functioning autism. But I do want you to keep in mind, when we're talking about people at the mild end of the spectrum, we still are not including people who are just characters. This doesn't include someone who's just quirky. It means that really the deficits in those areas are significant, and they do make it difficult for this person to manage in education, work, and just life skills in our environment. Autism was first described by Kanner in 1943, and at just about the same time, Hans Asperger in Germany produced a paper in 1944 which described Asperger syndrome, or what was later called Asperger syndrome. But they both described this condition at about the same time. However, Asperger's syndrome was not actually separated out as a category separate from autism in the official diagnostic guidelines until 1994, when the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual from the APA was developed. So there may be many adults who may have Asperger at this time, but were never diagnosed because it is a fairly new thing to have this separated out from the autism itself. But I do need to tell you that they are currently revising the diagnostic descriptions for autism, and the recommendation is that Asperger's syndrome will again be combined with autism, and it will not be considered a separate category. Now, that's caused a lot of debate among people who work with people with Asperger and feel that there really are differences. But the research has not been there to validate real differences between high-functioning autism and people with Asperger disorder. So when I talk throughout this presentation, I may use either high-functioning autism or Asperger disorder, but I'm really talking about the same group of people. I'm going to combine them as well in this presentation. Currently, when we do have a distinction between the two, high-functioning autism is not actually a formal diagnostic category. That's a term we use for our convenience to describe people who have autism but who will score above 70 on an IQ test, meaning that despite their disabilities, they are scoring at average or above average intelligence. And so we simply refer to them as high-functioning autistic. And diagnostically, if we separate out someone who has Asperger's syndrome, we are doing so based on when language developed. So we say that people who are autistic typically have delayed speech and language. And people with autism spectrum would have evidence that they have used a few single words by the age of 2 and are using phrases by the age of 3. Whereas someone with high-functioning autism would have a history of not having that early language development. Now, there's a table you probably can't read. Maybe you can. However, clinicians who work with both these populations, they see some distinctions, so I will share those with you as well, because you may be in agreement if you have family members and so on. There is a lot of overlap, and some people will report there are some differences. In terms of social skills, both people with high-functioning autism and people with Asperger's syndrome have some severe delays, and those social deficits may be the first thing that's noticed for children with Asperger's syndrome. In terms of restricted interests, some people believe that people who have autism are more interested in things, in objects. They might be collecting items, might be more interested in trains or drain pipes or particular toilet plungers. In fact, there's a lot of research just on, wow, the wide range of objects that fascinate some people. Whereas people with Asperger's syndrome seem to be more interested in fact-based systems. So they might know all the characteristics and types of dinosaurs. Or they might have memorized train schedules and be able to tell you when departures are from any city on any day, for example. In terms of language, as I said before, people with high-functioning autism would have delayed speech, very few words. They might have developed speech as a toddler and then lost it, and that's called regression, and they might stop using their language. They might have echolalia, which just means they repeat what someone speaks to them before they have useful language. And this is our biggest difference. Many people are diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome based on their language ability. In fact, we might see very young children with advanced vocabularies. They may speak very early, but they still have some differences in their language. It may seem odd. It might be a little too formal. It might not be age appropriate. They may take literal meanings literally. And therefore, if you said it's raining cats and dogs, they want to go see the cats and dogs that are falling because they may not understand metaphor and symbolism. And they have what we have we call poor pragmatics. Maybe the easiest way to describe pragmatics is it's how you use language to help you out, and it's how you interact with other people socially. It includes things like being able to take turns and knowing when it's a good time to ask for something and not interrupting and all of the business end of language. For both groups, we only call them high-functioning and Asperger if their IQ scores are above 70, and that is to say if they fall into the average and above average range. Motor abilities may look a little different. We think people with autism will typically have somewhat intact motor skills early on, whereas Asperger kids might always look clumsy and have some poor coordination. And the way the problem presents is a little different. The first thing we'll notice about a child with autism is that delayed speech, because we expect children to be starting to use their words by 18 months or so. And so when those fail to develop, that might be the first reason for referral. And so referral for a child eventually diagnosed with autism averages about 30 months, diagnosis by 35 months. And actually, that number is really coming down, because we've even gotten to the point where we've successfully diagnosed children as young as 14 months. We're trying very hard to diagnose earlier and earlier so we can start treatment as early as possible. Whereas the child with Asperger's syndrome, because language is not a problem, may not look that different from other children until preschool age, when we start to look for him to develop a best friend, have some friendship circles, be more social, and that person may end up being a loner and left out. And then we start to worry because those social skills have not developed. So therefore, Asperger's syndrome is typically diagnosed at a later date, probably after the age of 4. Gender ratio is a little bit different. In autism, it's predominantly males, but it's about 4 males to 1 female. In Asperger's, it's even more predominantly male. So it may be 10 to 15 males for 1 girl with Asperger's syndrome. And genetically, we like to say that genes probably load the gun, and some environmental factor probably pulls the trigger in the case of autism spectrum disorder. And for children with autism, we do see some inheritance patterns in families. If you already have a child with autism, you have a slightly higher risk of having a second child with autism. When we have identical twins, much more likely that the twin is also autistic, but not 100%, which means it's not entirely genetic. But with Asperger's syndrome, we do very often see parents who have Asperger's syndrome having children who have Asperger's syndrome. So that one we really do see a strong genetic link. The prognosis, what's the future hold for these kids? Well, of course, if you're someone with high-functioning autism, your likelihood of success is much higher than for people who have lower IQs, because they're going to be battling an intellectual disability all their lives. But the likelihood for success for people with Asperger's syndrome still remains higher than it does for people with high-functioning autism. We know now that we have about 1 out of 100 young children being diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder. And about half of them at this point will be high-functioning autistics or people with Asperger's syndrome. And I see varying opinions on whether there are more people with autism or more people with Asperger's syndrome. I think when you go to websites, you tend to see people saying, oh, Asperger's syndrome is far more common. But when I go to researchers whom I trust, who have really looked at the numbers, they believe autism is still more common than Asperger's syndrome. Finding I have to push this about 2 or 3 times. There we go. So let's talk about each one of those characteristics. This is a quote from a person with Asperger's syndrome. I think that I might be an alien who has been put on this planet by mistake. I hope this is so, because that means there might be other people out there in the universe like me. The difficulty with people with Asperger's syndrome and high-functioning autism is you don't feel like you fit in. And there are a number of reasons why you might not feel like you fit in. flat affect is something that we often see with people with high-functioning autism or Asperger's syndrome, and that means that your face does not express your feelings. So your expression may not change, and that makes it difficult for people to relate to you because we even unconsciously rely on matching what you're saying to the facial expression that you're giving us. And when we don't see your facial expression changing, we don't quite trust what we're hearing in the words. It makes it hard for us to relate to you. And so we tend to have few friendships. They may be overly rule-governed and literal, which means if I've been taught this is how I'm supposed to behave in a situation, then this is how I behave. And I'm not very flexible when the situation changes a little bit. And I may critique other people because they're not following the rules that I have learned because of my inflexibility. And I have difficulty understanding social interaction. I don't know how close it's okay to stand to someone when I'm talking to them. And I've been told I need to make eye contact, but I don't realize that staring unblinkingly for 30 seconds at someone in a conversation is not appropriate. So, and I may be accused of lacking empathy, because I have deficits in what we call mind reading. I have a hard time understanding how you're feeling. I may know that I'm sad, but I may not recognize that you're sad or angry or happy. And so I don't respond to you. I don't change my mood to fit your mood because I don't have any idea what your mood is. And so all of those things interfere with social relationships. Whoops. Well, that time it worked too well. Another quote. It's like I'm always playing a game to try to look normal, but it's hard work. I don't always end up getting it right, so I end up getting tired with it all. Language is difficult even for people with Asperger's syndrome who seem to have developed their vocabulary early and have high vocabulary. Again, the poor pragmatics that we talked about. I don't understand turn-taking. I may be fascinated with a subject, so I keep talking. And I don't understand that you would like to talk about something. I don't stop my conversation and let you have a turn. And I may not be able to take your perspective. I might not understand that you're not as fascinated with a topic as I am, or that you're trying to interrupt and interject, or that you're busy and you need to leave, and I may not be picking up on those signs. You may have poor speech prosody. And what we mean by that is the voice rising and falling, the use of inflection. So I may talk in a monotone, and after a while you may get tired of hearing me talk in a monotone, but I don't have very much difference in my inflections and so on. And so, again, the language is not well received by the listener. And I have difficulty understanding and expressing emotion. My use of language may be different, too. I might like to dwell on certain topics at great length. And because of my poor ability to read your facial expressions and your body language, I may not understand when you're bored and want to change the subject. And I have a lot of difficulty interpreting non-literal language. And I might not understand when you're being sarcastic, when you walk out of the test and say, well, that was really easy. And you're in fact saying that was hard, I think, wow, the test was really easy for him because I'm going to take you for exactly what your words say. I may have difficulty with metaphor and symbolism. So when I'm working in a philosophy course or studying about religion or trying to read a novel, I may not get the symbolism that's in there. Those subtleties may be beyond my understanding. Now, I'll caution you, of course, that this doesn't mean that everyone has the same deficits. And I certainly have known people with Asperger's syndrome who had great sense of humor, for example, which you would find difficult to believe if they couldn't understand irony, metaphor, and so on. Movement coordination may be different for this group as well. Sometimes I would hide just so I didn't have to feel so awkward and stupid. you will, a person with high-functioning autism and Asperger's syndrome might even look different at a distance. They might be set apart and seem a little odd, even when you see them coming, in part because there may be a different pattern to walking, maybe a little different physical posture that they're using. Some of that's in response to some neurological differences that they have in terms of the kinesthetic input that they're getting and their ability to use balance and so on as they move. And their clumsiness, they may actually look a little bit different. So suddenly you're a little set apart from a social group even before you've opened your mouth or someone's gotten to know you because you look a little different, a little out of place. Tend to have clumsy fine motor skills, so handwriting can be a disaster for people with high-functioning autism and Asperger's syndrome. And in school, I've seen children who were in sixth grade reading at a college level, but handwriting at a second grade level, which meant the teachers didn't want to promote him, didn't want him to move on and so on, even though his intelligence was not questioned, but that ability to handwrite got in the way. Poor eye-hand coordination, stereotyped motor movements, poor performance at games. That poor eye-hand coordination, you're going to go out and play baseball? You know, you're going to be a tennis player? Are you going to do those things that other people do as groups and are excited about who are your peers? Probably not. And so, again, you're left out of the social circle. And poor sensory modulation. Just the perception of sensory input may be very different from someone who is what we call neurotypical, normal person, who doesn't have a neurological disorder. We also see differences in terms of emotional and behavioral development. Asperger's people and autistics are judged the way ballerinas would be if you looked only at their feet. You would see deformity, pain, ugliness. You would refuse to consider the strength, determination, and beauty that resulted in those feet. People with Asperger and high-functioning autism may have poor self-regulation, which means I might not recognize that I'm getting angry, I might not recognize that I'm getting sad, and then when it's gotten to a point where I can't control it and, you know, my head's ready to explode, I can't calm myself. I don't regulate myself very well. So I may not recognize the buildup, may not have strategies for how to calm down when that's occurring, and therefore my behavior or my emotional expression may seem out of proportion to the situation. I may have rigid behavior, again, because of my understanding of the rules and my inability to be flexible about that. And I can be really distressed when routines are disrupted. We know that with this group of people, routines are really important. Routines are comforting. Routine is something that's predictable, that I can depend on, and those are important to me. So when you make a left instead of a right when you're driving me to school, I have a tantrum because this is really hard on me. You messed up my routine. And I may have a need for rituals. And I tend to have more obsessive-compulsive behaviors. Worked with a young preschooler who liked action figures and had 4 action figures that had to be in his pocket all of the time. And if you lost an action figure, you know, it was like losing that 2-year-old's blankie or binky. You can't go anywhere. We have to find them. And when I'm sitting at the table and I'm supposed to be doing art, I have to check and make sure my action figures are there. And I need to watch them and that has to be my main focus of attention. And I can be very anxious when I'm overwhelmed, and I'm often overwhelmed. We'll talk about the sensory perception issues. The things that you are able to totally ignore in this room could be driving someone crazy who has a neurodevelopmental disorder. So you may hear the fans running, and that just may be like somebody dripping that cold water in the back of your neck over and over again. Or you sit in a classroom and the fluorescent lights are on, but to you, they're not a solid beam of light. It's flickering, and you see all of the flickers and so on. And as that you become overwhelmed, you become more and more anxious. So we see some problem behaviors. Very often, they're related to my concrete understanding of social interaction. I don't pick up on the subtleties. I can't read your body language. And I can't be very flexible from the rules that I've learned. And it can be a lot worse in novel situations, because there you're asking me to be intuitive. You're asking me to problem solve on my feet, which is not something I can do very easily. I've had to consciously learn how I'm supposed to interact with the environment. And if that game plan isn't working, I don't really know what to do next. And I'm not going to be able to come up with a solution very quickly because I don't have those intuitive problem-solving skills. And unfortunately, not only in terms of inflicting problems, people with Asperger's syndrome tend to be the group that has the highest rate of bullying and harassment of any of our disability groups. Many other people pick on that odd man out. And so we have to really watch out for kids with high-functioning autism and Asperger, because they are very often the victim of their peers in a very abusive way. In addition, because this is really a neurological problem, I am also prone to having some other conditions in addition to Asperger syndrome and autism. For example, attention deficit hyperactivity, ADHD, is so common among kids with Asperger syndrome that very often the first thing they're referred for is their ADHD. The teachers say, whoa, this kid is out of control, and then later they may be diagnosed with also having Asperger syndrome. But very often it's that hyperactivity that's first noticed. They may have difficulty with their compulsions. They also have sleep problems. They tend to have difficulty getting to sleep, having difficulty staying at sleep, don't sleep long enough each day, and you figure out what you're like when you're tired. They have a high rate of anxieties and fears and a high rate of depression, and may develop physical tics or signs that you might pick up, especially when they're anxious and overwhelmed with stress. They also actually have some mental health disorders more frequently than other people. These tend to develop in adolescence and early adulthood, so we might see we do see a greater tendency to have bipolar disorder, for example, to have severe depression. And we see a much higher rate of thoughts of suicide and a higher rate of completion of suicide. So these are all things that we need to be on the lookout for this population. Well, let's talk about sensory perception. Autism is about finding a way to survive in an overwhelming, confusing world. It is about developing differently, in a different pace, and with different leaps. Sensory perception may be very different than it is for normal people. And you may have hyposensitivity, which means I have reduced sensitivity to input. Or I may be hyper, which means I'm very sensitive to sensory input. And it can be from really any of the senses. Visual, sound, smells, taste, textures, balance, and movement sensations. So let's say I'm hypo or very low sensitive to a tactile stimulation or touch. Well, I may not sense very much tactilely, and I may work to get more tactile sensation. I may end up biting myself. I may end up banging my head and so on, because I have such low sensitivity to that input that I like that sensory input, and I may do it more often. Or on the other hand, if I'm hypersensitive and you pat me on the back, a light touch, it may feel painful and really uncomfortable to me. I'd rather you gave me a nice... that light touch is just not going to function for me. And the same would be true of the lighting, of the sounds. I'm in a classroom, with 25 other children, and you're doing learning centers, and everybody's moving at the same time, and everybody's talking at the same time, and the teacher's giving instructions, and the people next to me are whispering, and each corner of the room is decorated with bright colors and so on, how am I going to respond? I could very easily be overwhelmed. And as I'm overwhelmed, I become more anxious, and I become more exhausted. And this tends to be a big issue for high-functioning autistics and people with Asperger's syndrome. And we also find that we have a problem with what's called executive function. Executive function is the work of the frontal lobe of the brain. And this part of our brain helps us with problem solving, with planning for our future, with controlling our impulses, which means stop, think before you act. If I have trouble with that, I will act, think about it later. I may have difficulty with inhibition, especially irrelevant thoughts. So if you've ever been in that situation where you said, oh, did I just say that out loud? Well, this person does. Says it out loud without thought to what's happening. And it may not be on the topic at all. It may be right out of left field. So that can be difficult. Difficulty organizing. So yes, academically, I might be strong. I might be able to learn. But I lost the work that I did get done. And I didn't write down the assignments, so I don't actually know what's due. And I am putting all my time into doing something that's 2 weeks from now and not preparing for tomorrow's test because my organization skills are poor. And again, that difficulty with flexibility is an issue. Special interest. I pace and paint. I stim and paint. I think about my work most of the time. I am sickeningly happy for the first time in my life. And this is quite a feat, considering I only felt the feeling of happiness for the first time in my mid-30s. And that's a quote from someone with high-functioning autism. This 80 to 90% of individuals with Asperger's syndrome have an all-consuming special interest, or more than one interest. And these interests can be unusual and intense. And they can, I may be so determined and so engaged in those special interests that I exclude all other age-appropriate activities that I should be involved in. I may be preoccupied with particular objects or fact systems. So, if you have all those characteristics and you're the cat in a dog's world, what does that mean for you and how you survive in this particular world? Let me give you an analogy that maybe you can relate to. I can relate to it because I'm a baby boomer. Okay. So if you're between 50 and 65, don't try to guess where I am on that spectrum, you're probably a baby boomer. Now, I was a baby boomer who grew up on a very old-fashioned farm, so I'm probably worse off than most baby boomers because the first record player that I had was a Victrola that you cranked up and you put a huge, thick disc on to play. And as you're cranking wound down, it played slower and slower, right? And the first telephone I had was a cylinder where you talked into one part of it and held the other cylinder up to your ear. And we actually would pick up the receiver, and an operator would answer, and I would tell the operator what number I wanted, and she would plug it into a switchboard. The first television I had was black and white, and of course there were 3 channels. And I was the remote, because you just sent the child to change the channels and to fine-tune things, because the adults had no idea really how that television worked. And I can remember when stereo hi-fi came out and how exciting that was. And probably the biggest innovation was the transistor radio. A little portable radio that we could carry with us that worked on batteries. And how cool was that? And when I first learned about computers, I had to learn 2 different computer languages for programming the computer. And I had to work a key punch where I punched holes into cardboard cards. And you guys can't even fathom what this looks like now. And I had a big stack of cards just to do a mathematical calculation for me. And I would go to a special building that held the one computer on campus. And there was a hallway around the huge main room that made up that building, where I would feed in my cardboard cards and it would come back with a calculation for me so I could do statistics on my research papers or something. Now, a digital native, well, that baby boomer, maybe that's not you, but it might be your parent, it might be your grandparents. More of you are digital natives. So you don't even remember what life was like without a cell phone, or at least a portable phone. And you don't know what life was like without a laptop. And there have always been CDs, and there have always been DVDs. And you have an iPhone right now. So you're a digital native. But to me, technology is not natural. It's something I had to learn. It wasn't something I was born into. So how would this affect how I learn? Well, I'm pretty mechanical and rote. I have to have all the steps in front of me, and I have to memorize, and I have to stop and think about what's the sequence for turning on my computer, and how do I access this, and how do I make this happen on my computer? Whereas if you're a digital native, you're intuitive. You don't need to look for instructions. I mean, I'm the one that actually does the tutorials that they send you with your software program. I sit and do the tutorials. It takes a long time to do them, but I have to do them. You don't need any of that. You take one look at the screen, you start pushing buttons, things happen. I am clumsy. I am slow when it comes to technology. Digital natives are not. Digital natives are fluent. It can respond quickly. You're comfortable. You're happy with your technology. I'm not that happy with technology. I get tired on the computer. I get stressed out. Now, I want to remind you, I'm a fairly high-functioning baby boomer. I made this PowerPoint all by myself. Nobody helped me. You know, I grade my assignments on the computer. I'm pretty high-functioning, but the way I navigate is really different from a digital native. My children are connected, immersed, have to have their computers all of the time. We can't get our son to visit because he might have to leave his computer at home and use ours, which is obviously too slow and can't handle the games that he's used to and so on. We tried to go to our cabin overnight and had to take the kids to into town where they could get free Wi-Fi so they could be connected and get caught up on everything they had missed in the last 12 hours. Okay? Me, I would rather avoid, I would escape it. Okay, I'm sorry, students. I took the texting function off my telephone because I don't want to text. It's hard work for me to do that. I'm not a native. My children asked me if I would like a Kindle. I saw you reading your book from a Kindle. And I said, why would I want a Kindle? That's work. I want to relax with a book. I want paper and print. I don't want to be looking at a computer screen when I'm supposed to be relaxing because it's work for me to do that. So how do I learn versus how a digital native learns? Digital natives explore. You don't need a guideline. You just start pushing buttons. I'm scared to death to push a button because something might crash. Scared to death. I'm going to call the helpline first and see if it's okay to do that. I need explicit instruction. It drives me crazy that we don't get a printed manual with every set of software that we get, because I just want to look up the page and read it. I don't even like the fact that our directory is on the computer. I want a paper directory. It has to be very explicit, very spelled out for me. Digital natives, you did it once, you got it down. No problem. You can always go back and run that program again because you did it once. I have to have repeated instruction. I go to the training sessions, but the first time it doesn't take, I have to be inoculated 2-3 times. I have to have repeated instruction. And I have to practice it. If I don't use it every day, I will forget how something runs. Digital natives, you are motivated by innovations. If it's new technology, you're interested. Look how fast the iPad is selling. People want one. Why? I don't know, but it's new. I want one. I'm not motivated just because it's new. I'm not getting that Kindle. But I am motivated when it suits my special interest. And I'll tell you, digital natives right now, I know that I can access the library computer bases to get full research articles better than any one of you. And I've done it a lot. And I love that function because that's my interest. So I will pursue that part of technology. whereas other things can go by the wayside. And you can be pretty independent. I am not independent. I'm so glad we have a computer helpline, and I use it a lot. Hello? I know you told me to go to download this, but I don't know what buttons to push, and I can't make it happen. And they talk me through it. But I always need somebody there to support me. Well, if you look at that difference between that baby boomer and technology versus the digital native who's grown up with all of this, doesn't have any anxiety about it, can move fluently through it, this is what it's like. The person with Asperger and high-functioning autism is the baby boomer in a world that was built for digital natives. So let's talk about what we can do to help them. Now, if you came to my presentation last year, I tried to present data to you on treatment that we had a good research base and knew was effective, and some things that we thought were promising practices. We didn't quite have enough research to feel that we could ensure its effectiveness, but it looked like it was a good option. In this area, we don't have very much research with high-functioning autism and Asperger syndrome. We simply have spent so much of our attention with people who had more severe disabilities in terms of autism spectrum disorder. Now, we haven't paid very much attention to people who had milder disabilities and were getting along. Not great, but they were getting along, and they haven't received as much research attention as we would like. So what I will share with you tonight are primarily promising practices. These are things we've learned from people who've worked a lot with people who have Asperger's syndrome and would recommend, but we still don't necessarily have good research to validate this. So if you're interested in research, these are some good areas to look at. Here's what we do know about teaching and learning, since a lot of you were teachers in this class, in this room tonight. We know that small settings seem to be preferable, and if you can individualize the instruction for a particular student, that student is likely to be more successful. So if someone calls and asks me about a student with Asperger that they want to send to a university, I would probably say, look for a small campus. Now, Whitworth actually would be a great place because it's a fairly small system. You won't get lost among the thousands and thousands of students at a large university. Or if you're going to a large university, go to Arizona State, where they have student services that you can purchase and get a tutor with every class, but they serve about 200 students. So there'll be people there that do understand and get to know you. So small settings seem to be helpful. We know that instruction has to include not just academics, because academics might actually be your strength area, though there'll be some challenges there as well, but also those pragmatics of social skills. What can I do to learn about how to be more adept socially and in using my language? That needs to be a part of the instruction, not just the academics. And I need to have opportunities for social interaction in a supervised, structured setting so that I'm not left to be the victim of a bully. And I'm not going to extend myself and then be rejected. I need to be able to do that socialization in a safe way. We know that you need explicit instruction just like the baby boomer. The person with autism, high-functioning autism, and Asperger's syndrome can't read between the lines, can't pick up on the subtleties, doesn't infer very well. And so many of us do so much that we do socially and with language without any formal instruction. We just picked it up naturally from watching other people, and that is not going to happen with somebody who has high-functioning autism or Asperger's syndrome. You need to tell me exactly what it is that I'm supposed to do. You need to demonstrate for me, provide a model for me, show me what it looks like, show me a video model. Show me peers who are doing what I'm supposed to learn to do so that I can pick up on it quicker. I even need written scripts. If you can spell out for me what I should be saying or doing in a situation, and I actually have it in print in front of me, that's great. And you know what? I can learn to write my own scripts. Once I do start to understand a situation, I can write my own scripts and have it in front of me to remind me of what I should be doing or saying in a situation. And always, always, always combine visual with auditory. Auditory is not my strong point. It is not a strength for me at all. And I need visual, so I need photographs or drawings or icons or print, something to go along with what I'm hearing. And I need to rehearse repeatedly. I need to do this over and over again so that I can practice and do it at a fluent speed. Let me give you an example of an explicit instruction strategy. This is actually one that we have a fair amount of research on. It's the only one I'm going to talk about tonight that is pretty well researched and is considered an evidence-based practice. It's called social stories. A social story is written with a certain format. It's usually describes a situation, a concept, or a social skill in a way that's meaningful for people with ASD, autism spectrum disorder. So let's say I'm going to be moving into a new situation. Something's coming up that's going to be hard for me. The social story helps to lay out what's going to happen, and it uses visuals along with sentences that I read. So I've got photographs, pictures, or icons in it. And then after I've read the story, I can respond to questions and I can role play what happened in the story. It might describe the sequence of events that will happen. It might describe the people involved. It might describe their thoughts and feelings. And I could even be videotaped as I role play and have you sit with me and watch the video and give me some feedback. So let's say, for example, I'm an eighth grader and next year I'm going to go to high school. Now, I've adjusted to a lot of things. I know how to change classes and I know about homerooms. I know about having different teachers throughout the day. But maybe in this particular high school, it's going to be the first time I have a locker. You remember, I still have nightmares about forgetting my locker combination. Anybody else willing to say that? Maybe I need a social story about what it's going to be like when I use my locker. That's a pretty unstructured, unsupervised area. A lot of things can happen. So maybe in the social story, there'll be a photograph. We'll go to the school and we'll take photographs of what that bank of lockers looks like. We'll take photographs of when other people are standing at the lockers. We'll talk about the fact that when I go to a locker, I'm going to have to enter a combination. What is the combination for my lock? Let's rehearse that. What might happen if someone is standing in front of my locker? What do I need to do? I need to ask them to move in a polite way. Or what happens if I forget my locker combination? Where do I go? So social stories would help me handle the situation, the sequence of events that's going to occur. We'll talk through what I need to do in those situations. And I may reread and reread that story for a week before I start high school. So the first time I go to use lockers, I'm prepared, I'm oriented, I'm ready to do that. Another example of explicit instruction that, again, has limited research, but the research that has occurred has shown some very strong effects. It's very helpful. And this deals with that problem solving in a situation that's new to you. It's called SODA. And SODA just stands for stop, observe, deliberate, and act. And I need to learn this strategy. These are going to be some self-talk that I have to do when I go into a new situation, and will help me figure out what I will say and do when I'm participating in social activity. Let's say that new high schooler is going to go for the first time to a school dance. Having been in this social situation, mom's not going to go with me. I would die if that happened, right? Dad's not going to be there. I'm going to be on my own at the school dance. So first I need to stop. Where should I go to observe? What's the room arrangement? What's the routine or schedule? Well, maybe I notice all the guys are hanging out against that back wall. That might be a good place to go stand. And while I'm standing there, I figure out all the refreshments are at this end. There's a band over here that's playing on a platform. There's a clear space that people are stepping into to dance. There are very few tables where people could sit and eat and drink, but most people aren't doing that at all. And the girls are all clustered over at another end of the room. Maybe I should have said junior high dance. Sorry. It's a junior high dance. And I have to observe. I'm going to ask myself, well, what are the guys doing? What are they saying? What happens when they say and do these things? So I watch for a while. Yeah, a guy is checking out the girls, and they're talking to each other about who they like to dance with. They go over, ask someone to dance. Sometimes the girls shake their head no, and they move on to a different girl, or they walk back to the wall. Sometimes they say yes, and they go out and dance. I have to deliberate. Well, what is it that I want to do? Am I going to get the nerve up to go dance? And what will I say when I do that? And how will I feel when I say those things? And how will I act when I say these things? How will they act? Why are they going to act that way? And I say, you know, I'm scared. I feel scared, but I want to do this. I want to go ask someone to dance. And that person may not know me or may not like me and might say no. Or that person might smile and say, okay, and we might go out and dance. And if the person says, yes, I'll go dance. If they say no, I'm going to come back here to the wall and go through my routine again. And then I act. And I've just decided in my head, this is what I'm doing. So where that strategy has been taught to people with Asperger's, it's helped them to maneuver in novel situations and do some problem solving. Because it's hard to be intuitive. We're not the digital natives. We have to be explicit and work this out in our heads first. Okay. Shifting gears. One thing you can do to help a person with high-functioning autism and Asperger's is to provide what I call stimulus shelters. And that is that if sensory input is so overwhelming, sometimes I need to be able to get away from it. You might make environmental accommodations. We've done this for years with students by putting a visual blockade around if somebody's highly distractible, for example. If I'm in a preschool, I might throw a long tablecloth over a table. And when a child is just getting overstimulated, he can slip under that table and get a little stimulus shelter for a minute. I don't want him to spend all his time under that table. I don't want him to escape all of the time. I just need to understand sometimes this person may need a break from that stimulation. I may need to give breaks frequently and give the student a way to ask for a break. Can I raise this red card? Could I make an arrangement with my professor and just say ahead of time, these lights in here drive me crazy, and sometimes when we're doing small group work and everyone's talking at once, I can't handle it. Could I just give you a little nod and step out in the hall for a few minutes, and then I'll come back in when things have quieted down or when I can handle it? But work that out ahead of time so you can have that break. You might want to reduce academic loads. You might want your child to be in school half a day, or a college student might take 4 classes and no more than that, or take 3 classes and 1 online who doesn't have to socialize and can do it in a quiet, comfortable place. Limit the school and work day. One thing we tend to do is we send kids to school all day, and as soon as they get home, they have to start their homework. But a child with Asperger's or autism may need to stop and take a break. I may need 2 hours to relax and download some of the anxiety that's built up during the day before I start my homework. I may need that shelter from overstimulation. Plan for some alone time. It's hard work being in a social situation when you don't have very good social and language skills. We say when students come on campus to college, actually the Asperger autism student should probably have a single room and not have a roommate. And it's not because you don't want the person to socialize, it's because sometimes they just need some quiet alone time when they don't have to interact with somebody else. And a single room might be a better way to go. You appreciate that? Okay. We can use special interests. This is something that Asperger put in his original work when he was first identifying students with what's now called Asperger syndrome. We can see in the autistic person far more clearly than with any normal child a predestination for a particular profession from earliest youth. A particular line of work often grows naturally out of their special abilities. Now, I think for too long we have worked really hard to discourage someone's special interest because it does seem to be all-consuming and dominates a lot of their time if you let it. We have sometimes discouraged or punished people for pursuing their special interest. But actually, this is what the research is telling us. We can use those special interests to motivate academics. So if a student needs to write a history paper, for example. But that person's real special interest is locomotives. Could that person not still show you academic skills and historical information by writing about how trains help to open up the West? And could talk, give you probably in great detail what trains were there and how they were built and when this happened. And could still demonstrate the competency in history, but actually be motivated to do the assignment because it in some way used a special interest. We've also found that when people are talking about their special interest, they can give you far more complex and capable responses. They are suddenly actually pretty fluent. So if you ask me how to access those databases in the library, I'm really good at that. I can teach you something about technology if you ask me about my special interest. So, for example, in a school, in a high school, we'd like this person with Asperger's to get some social experiences. Don't just call a group together of all the kids who have Asperger's. Call a group together of all the kids who are interested in 70s rock music, if that's that child's special interest. There are going to be other kids in the school who are really interested in 70s rock music. Right, Tim? And they're going to join, and suddenly this person's going to be more capable, have better language skills, better social skills, have a topic that's actually of interest to the other people in the group, and be able to be capable and competent in that particular setting. So we actually have data to show that this is true. When they're engaged in their special interests, they're actually much more capable. And so you've developed a good social setting, a setting where that person might be more successful. And you get 5 kids with Asperger in your school, and maybe 5 different special interests. Okay, after school special interest groups, here we come. We also find that when someone is engaged in their special interest area, it reduces anxiety. It helps to regulate stress. So that hour or 2 hours after school, when you're going to give the kid a break to de-stress before he has to start his homework, let him engage in the special interest. We actually find it reduces stress. It helps him calm. It's actually a good way to take that break. And what we're particularly interested for life success is to find any way we can take that special interest and work it into a marketable skill. So I have a person with autism who can play the piano like nobody's business. Can that person get into a music performance program or become a piano teacher or become a piano tuner or become someone who composes music for piano? What can we do that will move that special interest into a marketable skill? And then that person will get the job that we always wanted, right? Do what you love. Isn't that what we're told? We also know that support groups are helpful. And this time I'm talking about support groups that are members who are all Asperger syndrome, for example. A key feature is that they meet in a community setting, that it's got a predictable, structured format, and that the membership has some control over what happens in that particular setting. It shouldn't be too large a group. We find our most successful groups are 10 to 15 members. You might have 1 to 3 coordinators. A coordinator might be someone who does not have autism or Asperger, just to help keep things on track. Maybe someone who has an easier time engaging with people who have to make the arrangements for the place, the food, and that sort of thing. But the membership should be closed membership. And part of what that's about is it's a place where we can gather other people who have similar language and social deficits and be able to be comfortable with each other, not be watching how we say things and how we act all of the time. This is a place where I can relax. There should be explicit guidelines so that there is an established routine, so that it is a predictable and safe place, so I'm not going to have surprises. Usually, support groups meet monthly. They share recent experiences or concerns. So it's a little bit about like sitting around and say, wow, this is what happened to me. I didn't know. Boy, did I mess up. Or what did I do wrong? I didn't understand this reaction. And people talk to each other and give advice to each other and share their experiences. And then a good share of the program is just time to relax, drink snacks, and to practice socializing with other people who won't make you uncomfortable. They do support groups a lot in England. I always love reading their articles because the support groups always meet in pubs. I don't know. They're a great place for them. Okay. Let's look at this successful student who has academic skills who wants to go on for higher education. Data show that if you get even a couple of years of college, then your salary will be about 73% higher than for other people with high-functioning autism or Asperger who didn't get any higher education. So we know this is a good option. This is a good goal. We should try to get people into degree or certificate programs so they can get a higher education. But to make that successful, you have to start with a real orientation. You need to come to campus early. Find your way around campus. Find all the buildings where you will be going to classes. If you can, you need to meet your instructors. You need to have a conversation with your instructors and disclose what your disability is and what accommodations you might need to have. You should build a support team on campus that would include your instructors, but would also include the administration, for example. So go to meet Michael Leroy, our academic dean, and go to meet with the director of student services and meet your the residence life person who's been established in your dorm and set up regular meetings with a counselor and develop a support team of people who know what you are about and what your disabilities are. And then should problems develop, if there is a misunderstanding about what's happening, the people who count will know and won't necessarily assume that what you did was intentional or was with bad intentions. They will assume that you need some support or misunderstood a situation, and that can go a long way. I do want to emphasize the counselor. You should have a relationship with a counselor on campus. And part of this is because a person with Asperger or high-functioning autism is very prone to developing some mental health issues. And we need a professional who can be on guard for that and watch to see if you're becoming depressed, if there are changes in your mood and behavior, and could be someone who already knows you and that you're comfortable with. You need to be able to communicate. So parents, you're going to want to keep in touch by texting, telephoning, emailing. It's actually kind of nice that the first year or two is probably in the same town where your family lives, so you can visit frequently. I had a parent tell me that her son went away to school and she found out 2 years later that he'd never washed a dish in the apartment where he lived. After 2 years, she found out he hadn't washed his dishes because he didn't know how. It's just one of those skills that hadn't been developed. Monitor health and wellness. We really recommend that you set up, you become a patient of a physician who's near to campus. And in part because you may be on medication for anxiety. We know seizure disorders are very frequent among people with autism. You may be on seizure medication. It's very likely that you're on medication of some kind, and you want to have a physician that you trust. So if you need to adjust your levels, if you're starting to see side effects, you want your history there. So do connect with a physician. And you also want to monitor your health and wellness. Are you putting all your time, is it taking so much time to study that you're not getting exercise or you're not eating well now that you're independent of your parents and so on? Now, one thing I do want to mention to you is that there is a new Higher Education Opportunities Act, which is encouraging universities to develop programs for people with intellectual disabilities and autism, which would also count people with Asperger's syndrome. They're making it easier for people with these disabilities to receive scholarships and take out loans. They are funding some programs on campus to provide special supports like tutors for your classes. like classes that will help you with study skills or reading skills and so on. This is brand new. Just heard about it at a conference a week ago. But it's a real opportunity for people with these disorders to take advantage of higher education. If you are more interested in that, would like to follow up, go to www.thinkcollege.net, and that will take you to more information about what's opening up in higher education. What about beyond college? This particular disability area, which really fell under formal diagnosis only in 1994, is developing one of the fastest growing cultures we have ever seen. Some of you are familiar with deaf culture, understand the closeness of the deaf community because of the American Sign Language that they share and so on. But this is a culture of people with Asperger's and high-functioning autism. And adults can become attached to this and have other people that they can share their experiences with, even at a distance. There's a lot of internet connectivity, many sites with chat groups, many blogs and so on that you can participate in with other people who have Asperger's syndrome or high-functioning autism. There are also groups that hold conferences and hold group meetings. A couple of those are the Autism Network International and the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network. This group is very quickly becoming a culture that recognizes that they are cats in a dog's world, and that does not necessarily mean that they're on the outs. It means that they have some special abilities and skills to share as well, and they have eschewed political correctness to call themselves autistics and Aspies and not call themselves people with autism, though we push people first language here. But it's a part of them saying, if you call us people with autism, you are repeating to us over and over again that we have a disability, a disorder, that we're dysfunctional, that we're wrong. And we happen to be proud of it. We're autistics. We're Aspies. And we have something going for us. And so really, for the first time, this group of people will probably have a larger culture and a larger population with whom to relate. And that's not a bad thing. I'm going to end with this this quote in that regard. It's like coming home. I finally found a place where people don't care what you do. As far as nobody thinking you're weird or anything like that, it's just be yourself. It's like finding a world where you fit, where I'm not like an alien or something. I can get off the cure mentality. It's okay to be me. Thank you. Thank you so much for coming tonight. And I'm going to suggest, as I have in the past, I know some of you have questions and want to stay and ask those questions, but I know a lot of other people have family at home, it's hard to be out on a work day, or you have work to do over in the library. So let's take a little break. If you have questions, please come up here to the front two rows or so, and I'll be happy to stay and answer questions as long as you need me to. And we'll let the rest of you go home for tonight. Thank you very much. 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 Thank you very much.